Welcome to this new episode of FEPS Talks. I'm David Rinaldi, Director of Studies and Policies here at FEPS, the Foundation for European Progressive Studies. And I'm very thrilled to welcome here today at FEPS in our headquarters, Agnes Jongerius, member of the European Parliament, lead member of the S&D group. You have been basically, I would say, the leader of the S&D in this legislature on social and economic issues, because you have been the coordinator in the ELM committee for the S&D, but also the chair of the Social Europe Network for the Party of European Socialists. Plus, you have been, you know, pushing a lot for the big agenda of Social Europe. Agnes, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Okay. It's nice to be here. Yeah.
And, you know, the very first question, maybe I would say a general assessment on this legislature and on the different files that have been pushed forward. You have been at the forefront. We have been able to achieve maybe even more than we had expected at the beginning, at least, you know, from some operator and from myself as well. This is what it is, the perception. You have a similar perception of a rather exceptional legislature when it comes to social Europe, yes or no? And in case, what brought that about? How do you see, you know, what are the conditions that we had in order to achieve meaningful results?
You didn't say in your introduction that I was a trade union leader before coming to the European Parliament. And I must say, I came quite often to Brussels to meet in the headquarters of the European Trade Union Confederation, but also to take the streets to say to Barroso, please do something about social politics. And especially important after the banking crisis, when the European Commission forced quite a lot of member states to reduce their welfare states, to reduce their minimum wage, to push for austerity, and ordinary working people were suffering quite a lot. But our protests, our resolutions, and now the ETUC, didn't make any lasting impression. And even in the end of his mandate, Barroso came to one of the meetings of the ETUC board and say, yeah, sorry, but you know, as a commission, I'm responsible for three babies, the economics, the social, and the environmental. But in the banking crisis, it was clear the economic baby was ill, so I had to concentrate everything on that at the expense of both others. And that was indeed also my impression. So the Barroso years totally lost. In my opinion, a change of mind came first after the Brexit referendum, because I think quite a lot of people didn't expect, let's say, ordinary working men and women in the UK voting for Leave. While on the other hand, it's also clear that for them, when you say Brussels is only concentrating on the economy and doesn't give a bit about working people, then people said, why should I? Why should I care about what Brussels is doing? And I think after the Brexit referendum, a few people saw that it was time for change. And I think first we have to acknowledge the fact that Juncker saw this, coming from a country as Luxembourg, where social partners were always involved. But here I also want to pay tribute to Marie João Rodrigues, who grabbed the opportunity to push for this little booklet, the European Pillar of Social Rights. So Brexit referendum, the Gothenburg summit, where this booklet was being undersigned by Council, Commission and the Parliament, was the start of a change. And in this mandate, we even pushed further. So there was this pillar. Some changes were made, for instance, in the last mandate of Juncker, of the first, the only mandate of Juncker, like, for instance, the work-life balance for young parents and the posting of workers directive. But in this mandate, if you look closely at the first speech Ursula von der Leyen made in 2019 for the European Parliament, she promised us decent wages. She promised us to make an end of exploitation of platform workers. She promised us equal pay men and women. So she made quite a long list of commitments, and she didn't do this by herself, but this was because our political family have been pushing for this. And next to the Green Deal, which was also important in this mandate, the package of social commitments were made and were forced upon Ursula von der Leyen in the beginning of the mandate. And then we only need to keep pushing to not only have commitments in a first speech, but also make concrete proposals. And there I must say, Nicolas Schmit, as the Commissioner for Social Affairs and our lead candidate now, did a great job in pushing these proposals coming from the Commission to the Parliament and Council.
This is indeed true, because the feeling is that very much about politics is the organization and governance, but in the end, a lot boils down to the people that are there. And having Schmidt that was ready to kick in his work from day one with a clear motivation, you from the side of the Parliament, and you know, at the same time we had the Portuguese presidency relaunching on Porto, the Spanish presidency, now the Belgian presidency. You know, it's a feeling of having a situation in which we had a kind of a bulldozer with Schmidt in the commission, you and other colleagues at the S&D group, extremely influential, plus the support of some of the key presidencies that were also doing the extra mile. So somehow the governance and key people in key places were very relevant. So
also, let's say, the beginning
the European pillar of social
rights was also helpful in because there were a lot of people also in the commission and in the parliament who thought, the pre-European project is about earning money, and this whole, let's say, trickle-down economy thinking. So let's grow the internal market, and then everyone gets a bigger part of the cake, which is nonsense, of course. But there are indeed, I encountered colleagues who said, no, Juncker, that was the social commission. Now we are doing the real stuff again. But having this foundation, having the commitments of Ursula von der Leyen, and then pushing from different sides, from our political family, made this a quite successful mandate.
I don't know if it was the same for you, if you recognized since the onset the relevance of the pillar of social rights and the 20 principles, but as an observator of European affairs, at first I was a little bit skeptical, you know, of a document and a declaration without really binding power or, or an enforcement, you know, very principle. But then I have realized that actually it's a huge way and a great way to open up a political agenda. So it's not because, you know, the principles have an immediate application, but the ability to place something relevant in the agenda so that, you know, legislative actions can follow. And you can hammer on social issues even after. So the issue is a little bit now what we had the action plan as well. We had the action plan. We had a lot of moments now. Where do you think is the next step taking up? So how can we still maintain this high attention on the social issues? Not it's not that that the two things are contraposing, but now there's a lot of attention on competitiveness, industrial policy, the transitions, plural, how we can maintain the fact that the social outcomes of the transition, of the transformation remains relevant in the commission itself or in the presidencies.
Will not be easy. But like you said, indeed, the European pillar is now, it found its way in different policy areas. Huh? So it finds its way in the budgetary guidelines. It's mentioned in the RRF, so the Recovery and Resilience Fund. It's touched upon in the Net Zero Industry Act. So you see that the booklet itself is finding his way in the different policy areas, but still, for instance, this example of the Net Zero Industry Act, you see that they make it clear that everyone who wants to profit from the funding from this Net Zero Industry Act should take into account sustainability. And then it says, and it should make a choice between the social pillar, the cybercrime, or projects around payment on time. So let's say it's mentioned, but it's not there yet. Huh? And so every now and then, when I'm feeling a little bit low, I think, okay, we have been able to push this rock up the mountain, but now perhaps it's just falling back again. But here I think I'm deeply convinced that we, although the political arena will be changed after the elections, it's important that our political family is aligning with the other progressive forces, so with the Greens and with the left group, and demanding from the new commission, like the first commitment von der Leyen made in July 2019, we need to have the same kind of commitment in 2024, and I think we could work from the seeds we have been planting in this mandate, which, for instance, indeed about we made the minimum wage directive. In the minimum wage directive, it says it's very important that more workers are covered by collective bargaining. So I think we should introduce in the public procurement directive a condition that until 80% of the workers are covered by collective bargaining, no money is floating to this company or that project. So I think we have to be clever in combining all the seats which are there on the table. So public procurement, I think that's very important, is something which we can align the progressive forces with, and you can also make to, let's say, the other parties the simple question, why shouldn't we put our money where the law is? So I think we have the rhetoric on our side. Not only that, I was also, I must say, quite pleasantly surprised about the report of Enrico Letta, which was presented 2 months ago, something like that.
Even less.
Who was quite clear that an internal market can only function if the social fabric is also taken care of. So he is quite clearly promoting an other kind of economics, as Barroso did, huh? Ignoring the two babies because the economy was ill. Here, Letta is saying the economy, the internal market cannot flourish if you ignore people. and don't take care of their basic rights, as in the European of social rights. And even Draghi is now pleading for a massive investment also, because the trickle-down economy doesn't function. If we really want to make the change for a sustainable and social economy, then we have to have big investment also at the European level.
It comes to mind that perhaps we should consider our union not as three babies, but as one single baby, our society, that has actually different things that need to be taken care of at the same time. But taking care one only, it's not going to give a healthy society or a healthy baby. And I see a little bit the danger of going a little bit in the too much into the Draghi direction, that at least that his report is not public yet, but it's a lot about of course consolidation and making sense of the single market for big companies, you know, getting, you know, from 36 companies in the telecom sector to 4 companies in the telecom sector, so that we can have scale and we can use the investment appropriately. But I'm thinking, okay, what are the implications then, you know, that there are in terms of the movement of people, of working conditions, of even territorial and social cohesion, which are priorities of our union. So the feeling is that, okay, you know, we have to, you know, go to another stage of internal market probably. Mm-hmm. But indeed, as you are stressing and also is present in Letta's report, we have to make sure that the internal market is delivering for everybody, even if for people that are not moving to other places.
Yeah.
You know, how to get the internal market for everybody in a sense.
Yeah, and I think in that sense, when first Letta was talking about you don't only have the right to move, as one of the four freedoms, and not only a movement of capital, goods and services, but also of people. When he first started to talk about you also have the right to stay, then I was thinking, okay, what does he mean? But if really this will be a cornerstone of new economic thinking, then indeed cohesion policy are also part of it, and perhaps also put your investment not only put your money where the law is, but also put your investments where it's perhaps needed most in order for people to stay. Because I think indeed I will always defend the freedom of workers to move around, because you cannot say capital, goods and services are allowed to move, but people should stay in their place. That's not fair. We know that Western European companies destroyed quite some employment.
Yes.
In Central and East Europe. So there is also this fourth freedom, which we have to defend. But I think we trying to think what would it mean that you should not be forced to stay to earn a decent living is also an interesting challenge. And I think indeed you're right, thinking about all these issues separately will not do the trick. Although, of course, we know that, let's say, the big businesses are lobbying for only the economy. If we want to have the support of people of Europe for our cooperation and also all the things which are part of that, we should also take care of people. And therefore, I'm going back again to this European pillar of social rights. I know you cannot go to the butcher or the bakery and say, this is my pillar. Can I have my meat or my bread for free? But it's in a way a It's a to-do list where we have to work on. And for instance, here, housing is mentioned in number 19. There are people who say, housing, that's not a European competence. But if you see that everywhere in Europe, young people have problems in starting their lives because they have insecure labor contracts, but also no affordable housing, then we have to work on this and have to see how we can make it work for people. And then you can say, yeah, see, it's part of the European pillar, pillar 19. Please work on that. So I have this little booklet in my purse all of the time. It's useful.
It looks a little Bible, a little guide. Guidance. But indeed, since the European pillar of social rights was issued, even though it's, of course, difficult to communicate to people the value of it and what the socialists have done. But, you know, if I look at you mentioned the work-life balance directive, also the other one on predictable working conditions, so that people know exactly what they can find in their contract. And we ruled out zero-hour contracts, for instance. We had the equality strategy, the care strategy, the child union, the child guarantee, skills agenda. Everything is rooted in, of course, the minimum wage, a minimum and adequate wages. So a big agenda coming from Schmidt and Dalli and other Schure as well. You know, different things. You mentioned two things. Very relevant, housing and public procurement, two things in which you have jumped. So another moment to dig on this, and then I will have other two policy areas.
Okay.
But first, both maybe on housing and on public procurement. On housing, if you have ideas about actually what Europe can do, because this you mentioned there's not a lot of competencies at the European level, even though we had started a little bit through the Green Deal, maybe the renovation wave, so taking the angle of basically energy efficiency and in housing. So if you see it, because we notice also with the pandemics that it's there's a big inequalities in housing, ghettoization, but we have European issues, short-term rentals and marketization of the sector that is affecting Europe. All the big cities and all the countries. So what can literally the Union or the Parliament or the SND stand for? And I ask this, and then you answer, in package also, because I really would like to stress the point that you make on public procurement, because I find it extremely relevant. You have been able to push it back in the top of the agenda of the group, and therefore of the Union. This ability to shape the type of society and employment we want, thanks to the type of contracts that we give. We received several complaints in conferences. The one issue is that people are truly affected by is the fact that people keep on dying at the workplace.
Yeah.
Too much, too often. And then you go and check and you see that people have crazy contracts they are subcontracted by the subcontractor of the subcontractor. Can we end this practice with one simple European law that states clearly minimum standards for public procurement?
You want me to start with
to
that?
Housing or this? There you
go. Okay. Let's do housing first. And when I say housing first, that's also the name of the project in ending homelessness in Europe with a target 2030. And there you see, target setting. Is this really legislative work? No. But if target setting is leading to exchange of good practices, and at the moment there is also the platform Nicolas created for exchange between the member states, how to fight homelessness, working. The legislative proposals around short-term rentals are also working. But next to that, I think, yes, we could use the money of the Green Deal and let's prioritize it to start with the social housing and make them energy friendly. But I think in general, you could also see that if in the big cities, ordinary working men and women cannot live anymore, why should you work there? I was 2 months ago in Dublin, where you see there are a lot of, let's say, high-tech giants.
Yes.
In Dublin for tax reasons.
Yes.
But to attract people, the Metas of this world bought complete streets to house their expats. And now the city has real problems in attracting nurses, police officers, teachers, because they cannot afford to live there anymore, and then they rather live in another city. But there is a relation between the labor market
and
the access to affordable housing. And I think making a attempt to have a special, either via the IEB or otherwise, a special fund for building affordable housing, I think would be really very, very helpful. And I'm luckily Nicolas also took this as one of his campaign messages. I think having a deal in the start of the new commission on how to deal with this lack of affordable housing is with him in safe hands. Another way of having more money available for the social clauses is indeed using public procurement, because there's quite a lot of money floating around in the European Union.
Huh? Yes.
And here we are still working with this, let's say, old rules where in the public procurement directive it states that a member state, when transposing this directive to legislation, can take into account social clauses.
Can.
and there you see what is going to happen, because if it's can, then there is no obligation, and if there is no obligation, then the choice for just the cheapest bit will be taken, and there it's clear that cheapest bits are often at the expense of ordinary working men and women. So I think we need a change of the public procurement directive and have a shall instead of a can. You shall take into account the social clauses and of course also the sustainable clauses. But we should also do this when handing out European money directly.
Exactly.
So it's not only for the member states, I think it's also for the European Commission. And here, just at the end of the mandate, we decided in the parliament to make a public procurement alliance together with people from the left group, from the Greens, and also from the EPP. Of course, you can say the EPP will not agree.
As a whole, of course.
As a whole. But if we can build with this alliance, and I think we can also look after the more social inclined people in the liberal groups, I think we can have a majority to really push for a change in the directive and in the way European money is being handed out. And then we could push even more for the commitments we made in this mandate.
I think this sounds great. Sort of a smart and progressive conditionality for public procurement and European funds in order to make sure that health and safety at the workplace, but also, you know, contracts, quality of contracts, is guaranteed.
Trade union rights, democracy at work, all kinds of things.
That would be great.
Yeah.
In my mind, I'm thinking about a sort of triple dividend of EU money. So whenever there is EU financing, you need to have a dividend in investment, but also better working condition and better environmental conditions.
So, in that sense, you see that in some member states, our progressive family took the lead in. For instance, in Portugal,
yes,
they do it via tax credits. So if you are working with a collective agreement, you get a bigger tax refund as a company. So it balances out, but it's also making clear what your priorities are. And I think here I'm very much in favor of social legislation, full stop. But I think if we are able to integrate it in all these areas.
Yes, it's a mainstreaming of social in the different aspects. Otherwise, you take care of the industry and the social. You have to consider you have one baby, not different baby.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. But because we have one society and not completely different systems. Two additional policies that I would like to dig into and to get your input, because I've seen you very active on these in the last few years of your mandate, is the platform directive. That is exactly, you know, pushing for, if you want, rights in this new type of online works. And the other one is the zero unemployment territories, or the, you know, local job employment initiative that you have also been pushing for. It's the role of the public sector to create and activate social economy and job creation, quality job creations. So these two angles on the platform directive and the employment initiatives. What makes you hopeful? What do you like? What are the problems you see?
If it's about platform work, I do remember that I think in the last campaign, so the 2019 campaign, I was contacted by Uber drivers in Amsterdam. And they were like very unhappy about the way they were treated, and they wanted to go on strike and they wanted my advice. So I was in contact with them. They went to the head office of Uber, because the European headquarter in Amsterdam, because of tax reasons. they came there, and there I noticed, at least, no, I didn't notice, but they pointed it out to me, that there was a staff toilet. And they said, we are not allowed to use this staff toilet because Uber considers us not as staff. Huh? Staff are the people in accounting and marketing. We are just users of their digital services. So, and they even went this far as in declining them, denying them the rights to use the bathroom, which I think is really, it's inhuman. Here also I can make a reference to the European pillar, because it says in number 12, regardless of the type and the duration of the employment relationship, workers and in comparable conditions, self-employed, have the right to adequate social protection. And that is exactly what these platform workers are lacking, because the platform are not only denying them the right to use the staff bathroom, but also the right to unemployment protection, to pension, even to a minimum wage, because they say, yeah, we cannot guarantee how much you are being called for, and waiting time is your own time. People are not even getting a guaranteed minimum income. And here at the fighting of a big lobby of the platforms, because they are really filthy rich
and powerful. Yes,
powerful, have big lawyer firms, big advisory firms.
I would say well connected with liberal governments. Can we say that?
Yeah, it's not for nothing that the name of Emmanuel Macron is being mentioned in the Uber leaks. They are well connected. They are also well connected to my still Prime Minister Mark Rutte in the Netherlands. We succeeded in, with a call on this, succeeded in saying, okay, it's not the case that a worker should go to court themselves, him or herself, to claim the basic workers' rights. But let's assume that people are just a employee with the basic workers' rights, unless the platform can say for this worker or that one, he's an accountant, he's an IT specialist, it's a real self-employed person. So we were able to change in the legislation the presumption of an employment relationship and shifting the burden of proof from the worker.
So now the default is that they are employees.
And if the platform wants to say otherwise, they have to come up with
serious proof.
The serious proof that this is not the case. And yes, this has been a huge fight. My colleague Elisabetta Guamini fought this fight for our political family, and Nicolas had to fight it first to come up with the proposal, because in that stage there was already quite a lot of resistance. And yes, in the end, it was indeed Macron still voting against, the German government abstaining, because the liberals there in that government want to follow the line of Macron. And they have this agreement that if they don't think alike on European proposals, the government in the council have to abstain. But luckily we were able to get all the others on board. And indeed, in the last week, the European Parliament was sitting. We were able to push the yes button.
Yes.
For the proposal. I'm very happy with that. But then still, and that's something Nicolas is also saying, be it for the minimum wage directive, be it for the pay transparency directive, be it for the women on boards directive, be it for the platform directive, it's all about transposing and indeed make it in reality for those drivers in Amsterdam. But we made some progress there.
That's super. Maybe the other point on the other zero, policy on the zero unemployment, that I saw that you were very close to this initiative as well. How hopeful you are that we can see, we have seen something already now with Schmidt making available several millions for these
23 millions
for these,
which is serious money. It's indeed something we also were able just to indeed get announced at the end of this this parliament's mandate, and it's something where I worked on together with my colleague Aurore Laluc, because she's coming from France and she is quite connected to what in France is called the
Territoire Zéro Chômeur de Longue Durée.
Absolutely, thank you.
Or something like that.
Something like that. And there are 60 of them in France, where instead of just pushing unemployed people to the labor market, and if you want to be successful, try to do this with the people who are just out of job, because they are the most easy to get back to the labor market. There they had in this system of these territoires a combination of local stakeholders sitting around the table and starting just to invite people to say, come work with us. Instead of pushing people, inviting them and say, okay, if you come here, you get a labor contract, you get minimum wage, you get workers' rights. And we are going to look at what are your interests, your field of expertise, your skills. And we find something which is needed in the local community and is fitted for you. So I visited a project in one of the arrondissements of Paris, where people were cooking meals because they had done some catering experience, and now they are making meals for the local community with food which is which would otherwise be destroyed because near the end date, or making because people like to work with wood, big trunks for greening the streets and making trees in the streets with this big trunks, or assisting elderly in assisting them going to a hospital visit or to the pharmacy or just for the fun of it. It's a combination of local stakeholders offering people a job and a guarantee that they have their rights, and the needs in the local community are being catered for. And it's quite the same which I have seen in my country, in the town of Groningen, where they did the same. So the official policy in the Netherlands is people should take the shortest route from an benefit, social benefits, to work. And here they say, no, you get just a place. For instance, I met a man who was taking an eye on, is there a lot of stuff laying in the parks and on the streets? But he told me, in the end, my main job is taking care and cuddling the elderly because they are so lonely. So then Jonek, the deputy,
Paulette,
came with the proposals from Wallonia.
The region and the Wallonia, yes.
And he decided to make this an opinion of the Committee of the Region. Aurora Leluc and I, we said, okay, let's try to get a pilot project funded. And instead of a pilot project, now we have a complete budget line with 23 million euro available.
It's so good to see progressive people working and delivering for employment, to end unemployment, to activate people and communities, literally.
And making this, people-centered. So not centered around which is the quickest way to get you out of. About what's necessary for you, with the guarantees people also need to make the step. So
not the transfer, but the dignity of a job that is valued by your community, which makes it also sustainable over time.
Absolutely.
But Agnes, allow me maybe a more personal question. Could be a little bit political, but also personal. You know, something about your time, because you have been representing, in a sense, the labor and the socialist in your country. You know, be the head of delegation of the Dutch in the S&D group. You have been representing, as you mentioned, the trade unions at the European Parliament, which is not an easy task, and probably very much needed. Mm-hmm. You have been representing social policies for all Europeans in this period. So I would say three big weights on your shoulder. What are you most proud about? What, you know, could be of the achievements of the things done, of the role that you have played in this legislature and the previous one. Something, you know, a little bit of what make you happy and proud.
No, that we were able to integrate this policy in other fields of policies. Is of course it's not done by me only, but I can claim some ownership of that, and I'm proud of that. But I think if I'm really have to single out one thing, is that indeed, in this minimum wage directive, we are not talking about guaranteeing trade union rights and having more people covered by collective bargaining. And that's the real change in the European policy making, because we know the recipe of the Troika
was to abandon
collective bargaining. People are saying, oh, trade unions, that's something of the past, we don't need it anymore. Like a little bit of the talks of Uber, who are saying, oh, everyone wants to be flexible, and flexibility and basic rights are something of the 19th century, and now people can take care of themselves. With this milestone we put into the legislation, forcing member states to sit together with their social partners if they are not there at the 80%, and even in the Netherlands we are not there at the 80%, so forcing them to make a plan how to raise the level of people covered by collective bargaining is, I think, very interesting for now. I think it's also important in the whole enlargement of the European Union, because I think we should also make it clear to those who are all now invited to prepare themselves for a European membership. They should know this is part and parcel of what we are pushing for. So this 80% collective bargaining, therefore enforcing, enabling trade unions at national level to fight their fights. And perhaps I can be of some little use in different member states, because now when I'm not standing anymore, I have some free time on my hands. And if I can help in pushing this agenda further, I'm really love to do that. Yeah,
that's great to hear, and I think it would be extremely relevant to still hear from you on guidance and actions on how to, you know, expand the voice of trade unions and workers in EU policies, because that's very much needed. Maybe my last question, because not long ago at FEPS we published a study with the EPC, with Social Platform, Solidar and ACA Europe, on the social pillar and the future of the EU social agenda. A little bit, the study looks at the current implementation of the pillar, some of which aspect we have covered, but we also try to push on what is the type of social action plan we need in the next legislature. So try to bring some ideas on minimum income directive, something on fairness, intergenerational fairness, for instance. If you have to, you know, to suggest to the socialists, to the progressives, the Democrats, on one or two things that we should really focus on achieving in the next legislature, what are the one or two things that you would really like to see?
Next to changing the public procurement directive, I think that would be helpful. I myself am also very much in favor of a minimum income directive. And I know a lot of people are saying, well, it cannot be done, it's in, not in line with the treaties. But that they said about minimum wage too.
Exactly. So they didn't take Schmidt into account.
So I think here I do hope, and this study is helpful for that, that people are not giving up with one little pushback, because you get a lot of pushback. We also did in the past mandate, but I hope everyone will be assured that if you are able to resist this pushback and join the fight, because it's also nice that, you know, Nicolas is doing it here, I'm doing it in the parliament, if I need someone I can call the Minister of Social Affairs in Portugal, or indeed the Belgium two ministers who were very active on this field. So you also have to play the game smartly. But I think public procurement, a minimum income, because we have already in the action plan the reduction of poverty. And even though the commitment to reduce poverty has been made before the outbreak of the corona pandemic, we only have a few years left to really reach this target, and we have to reverse this growing inequality. And I think a focus point with pushing for a directive is also helpful to get the attention where we need to get it, and that should be in this rich continent. Children should be able to just go to school with a full stomach. A parent should be able to every now and then invite someone over for a play date, and not being afraid that people are looking, why is there no heating or no carpet on the floor? It's a debate about also human dignity, and fighting for a minimum income directive can be a nice symbol to fight for this dignity for all citizens in Europe.
Indeed. I think a union that prioritizes on dignity and ending poverty should be a union that makes us proud.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Agnes, for this, I would say, inspiring talk that looks at what we have achieved and still puts some grains on an initiative on what we have to achieve still. We had Agnes Jongerius with us, head of the Dutch delegation to the S&D and also coordinator in the EMP committee. Thanks a lot, Agnes. See you soon for the next episode of FEPS Talks, and you know, have a look on the nice material we have on our website on Social Europe, because this is a fight we all have to carry on.